The Guardian.
This is Politics Weekly. I'm Heather Stewart.
The rollout of universal credit is proceeding to plan, gradually and sensibly. People are moving into work faster and staying in work for longer.
Universal credit, the government's flagship welfare policy, gets a major new rollout across the country this week. But is it fit for purpose? Could it end up harming the people it's supposed to help? And how did a system meant to simplify benefits end up so complicated? Meanwhile, Parliament may be back, but party conference season is not quite over. We hear from the Green Party leader, Jonathan Bartley, and from our Scotland editor, Severin Carell, with the SNP in Glasgow.
We must and we will make the case for independence always.
But first, joining me in the studio, Guardian social policy editor Patrick Butler and Chris Goulden, Deputy Director of Policy at the Joseph Rowntree Foundation. From this week, the government is significantly accelerating the rollout of universal credit, the most radical reform of the welfare system in decades. It will be introduced to 45 new job centres this month and another 50 each month after that. But since it was conceived in 2010 by the Conservatives, UC, as it's known, has been beset by delays and problems. Among the most controversial aspects is the built-in delay of payments. Benefits are paid in arrears and many new claimants have to wait around 6 weeks to get their money. Chris Goulden, can you explain a bit more about how the system works and what it's meant to do?
Well, the original aim of universal credit was to massively simplify the benefit system. In the old system, there was a kind of build-up of different elements over time, over a very long time, over decades. And no one had really thought about how they kind of connected together, how they interacted, how they overlapped, and whether there were inconsistencies in different elements of the system, particularly for the working age elements, for people in and out of work. And that was one of the big divides, was between the system for people out of work and for people who are in work, which was primarily tax credits of different sorts. So universal credit was trying to bring all that together into one wrapper. So that's both in terms of its name and how that's communicated to people, the elements of its design, so how fast your money is withdrawn when you go into work or if you earn more money when you're in a job, bringing those elements together, that's the so-called taper rate in the system. Bringing those together was a real kind of ambition of the early design of the system, and that seems to me a very sensible thing to do, to try and align those and make it simpler for people, particularly going from unemployment into a job. Having the same system means that they don't have to reapply, because I think the old system put off a lot of people because they saw it as something different and it was a risk going from unemployment into a job. With a different system and a different government department, HMRC were responsible for tax credits, job centres responsible for unemployment benefits. So there are a whole range of ways that the system was kind of different and confusing for claimants. So universal credit is trying to overcome that heroically to bring those elements together, very much from the point of view of the claimant.
And it was quite widely supported at the time, right? I mean, Labour were happy with the principle, with this principle of bringing these different benefits together and giving you a sort of smoother system, whether you're in or out of work.
Yeah, I mean, the original idea came from the Centre for Social Justice, and they spent quite a long time developing,
which was Ian Duncan Smith's think tank,
yeah,
wasn't
exactly.
It? When he was out of government before he went.
Yeah. So the timing worked quite well for Ian Duncan Smith and for the Conservatives in terms of having that idea fairly well developed, reasonably well tested, theoretically, I mean, not in practice. And then IDS took it forward and implemented it, as we know.
Mm. So, Patrick Butler, it was a bold reform. It had a rationale behind it. How is it actually working in practice? How have we ended up where we are today?
Well, the system was, I think it was originally meant to be running at full speed now. So it's now 5 years beyond the original date that it was supposed to be completed by. Eventually, we think around 7 million households will be on universal credit. Currently, there's about 600,000. So it's way behind schedule. And I think this has been a combination of several things. I think there's been lots of problems developing the information technology. I think there's been lots of problems just trying to design the system that's going to work smoothly. And these things have conspired with politics. Money has been taken out of the system in the form of cuts and so on. And so, yet it's struggling. It's moving very slowly. And the problem now is they want to accelerate that rollout.
And Chris, that's part of what happened. Patrick mentioned those cuts there, but George Osborne went into the 2015 election saying he was going to take £12 billion quid out of the welfare bill. When people are moving over to this new system, it's a significantly less generous system, isn't it, because of that?
Yeah, I mean, part of the consequence of those delays that Patrick's talked about is that universal credit has kind of been hanging there, not fully implemented, and it's been ripe for cuts before it's kind of fully rolled out.
Because it feels like not real money, doesn't it? Cutting something that people aren't receiving yet.
But yeah. now it's really hitting people. And the changes to the original design have been quite large, particularly something JRF we're concerned about is the cuts to the work allowance, which is the amount of money you can keep when you first go into a job. In the original design from the CSJ, that was quite generous and affected quite a wide range of people. The amounts and the range of people that are allowed to have the work allowance has been cut back to save money. And we think that should be reversed and would be great for the ambition of getting more people into work, because it helps people to overcome that fear of the leap into a job when they've perhaps been out of work for quite a long time. If they know that there's a certain amount of money that they're definitely going to keep, they can kind of not worry so much about the effect on their bills and getting different payment methods and that sort of thing.
Which is exactly what Duncan Smith had in mind, right?
Exactly.
So that there was always an incentive to go into work. And how high now are those? They're called taper rates, aren't they? Or withdrawal rates. You know, how much of your extra money that you earn does the state then take back?
So the work allowance is a few hundred pounds a month for certain groups, and
you can earn without it being taken back.
And then the original proposed taper rate, so that's the rate that your money is withdrawn when you go into work beyond the work allowance or earn more when you're in a job, originally was around 50-55%, that's the proposal. And they did test out different options for that, and that was kind of thought to be the optimum rate. And then it was put in place at 65. So that's, on top of that, you might be paying tax and national insurance that pushes that effective rate up further. So you might lose even more. And has recently been cut back to 63% by the current government, which is helpful, but it is a marginal change. And we're yet to see really what effect that element of the system is going to have on people, because the only groups that we've got really good information for are single childless people. And their work incentives haven't really changed that much. So it's more that kind of lone parents and different families and the more complex households are the ones who are having the bigger changes. And we're yet to really see any evidence about what effect universal credit has had on them.
Hmm. Okay, and Patrick, what are you, you've been writing lots of stories about this. What do we know about how it's working in the real world for those people who are already in receipt of UC, for whom the rollout has already taken place?
It's a 42-day minimum wait for a first payment in universal credit. In some cases, this is 60, 65 days because of administrative problems. Now, if you're someone on a low income who probably doesn't have any savings, going for 6, 7, 8 weeks without any income at all is going to have, obviously, going to have negative impact on your life. So I think one of the problems with universal credit is this assumption that claimants could cope with a 6-week wait. Clearly, what we're finding now is they can't. The impact of that is we're seeing claimants go into rent arrears, they're going into debt, they're borrowing from family and friends, and in some cases from payday lenders. They're going to food banks. And I think one of the most striking things that we've found in terms of when we've talked to claimants about their experiences is just the sheer stress that this puts them under. And I think when people are in this position where they're stressed out and they're in debt and they're not quite sure when their first payment is coming, you just wonder how conducive is that to finding work or finding a new job or working longer hours. I think they've really got to think about how they make the system work better for the people that are going to have to use it. It's incredibly complex.
It's supposed to be simple.
It's supposed to be
that
simple.
That was the idea, wasn't it?
It's supposed to be simple, but in its latest iteration, it's online only. I think what people find that it's very difficult to move, particularly when you've been used to being paid weekly or fortnightly, then you moved on to monthly payments. Where the rental element is concerned, people have been used in some cases to having their housing benefit paid directly to the landlord, all of a sudden the housing benefit comes direct to them. And so they're handling huge amount or relatively big amounts of cash on a monthly basis. And they're finding it hard to budget. I think also they're finding that the system doesn't seem to work very well. It's not very user-friendly. As we've said, it's fiendishly complex. Often people are finding they get irregular payments from month to month. They don't know what the payment date is going to be. There are computer glitches and the system crashes. When things go wrong, it's incredibly difficult to get things corrected. You can't always call up. You've got to send emails, and that often they find that they can be waiting hours on an expensive premium rate line to fix things. So I think the consumer, if you like, the claimant experience, the consumer experience has been one which, frankly, if we were talking about experience of banking or a travel firm or an insurance firm, we'd be up in arms about.
And Chris, are these sort of teething problems that if you spent enough on the IT or if you put a bit more money into the system and made it a bit more generous, could be fixed? Or are they kind of inherent to universal credit?
I mean governments are terrible at big IT projects, as we know. But I think it is right to spend quite a long time rolling this out because it is such a huge change to the welfare system. So I think it's right that it is 5 years late and counting. Who knows if we will be there in 2022 or not. For sure, there are definitely IT issues. But I think there have been great successes in terms of getting that real-time information from employers into the system. Everyone thought that would just fall over and not work. But the evidence so far shows that for the bigger employers, at least, that some of those elements are working at least. But I do think there are fundamental problems with the design that Patrick has mentioned in terms of the delays in payments. So we think it would be much better if you could choose and kind of have the power and control over your payments. If you want it to go to your landlord, you can choose to do that from day one. If you want to split your payments within the household, give some to the father, some to the mother, you can decide to do that, and that should be up to you. But there seems to be this strange mix of empowerment and paternalism within the system. So you're forced to have it monthly in arrears, whether you like it or not, whether you're used to that or not.
And do you think David Gawke, the Working Pension Secretary, was forced to listen to lots of kind of concern and questions from MPs on both sides of the House yesterday about UC and this issue, these issues. And they're obviously showing up in constituency surgeries more and more in areas where it is being rolled out. Do you think the political pressure about this is going to keep building?
I think the political pressure will keep building. I think it's going to come from claimants in their constituencies. I think it's coming from landlords, not just the big social landlords who are racking up huge amounts in arrears now and are looking to have to evict tenants in some cases. It's coming from private landlords too. Private landlords are now saying, you know, good Tory voting private landlords saying, we will not take any tenants who are on universal credit simply because the system isn't fit for purpose. So ministers are getting pressure from all across the spectrum. And I think in some ways they're going to have to bow to that pressure at some point. And I suspect the question is the political one of how do you finesse a retreat on universal credit?
And what do you mean by retreat? We've got a budget coming up. One option is to put a bit more money in. So there was a change made already on the taper rate, wasn't there? That could be made a little bit more generous or sort of less brutal. Are there other things that could be done? When you say retreat, presumably you don't mean pausing the whole thing.
Well, it's a moot question as whether you have to pause or whether you can make the changes anyway. When people talk about pause, it's never quite clear to me, well, does that mean you're just going to stop operating the system? Or does it mean effects what people are talking about was let's stop and have a review, let's sit down, let's examine the evidence again, and let's work out how can we make this system work better for the people who have to use it.
Chris, does that make sense? Do you sense any feeling from government that they have concerns about this not going well, or are they? I mean, David Gawke wasn't signalling a retreat yesterday, certainly.
No, there's been no signals really. I think there are some things they could do in terms of the design, so particularly looking at the work allowances, it would be a much better use of any money that they have to spend, for instance, raising the work allowances than putting up the income tax threshold. It's much better targeted, and you can't really take the tax threshold much further without sort of
focusing on the middle. Because the lowest paid people are already,
the people that have been helped have been helped already. But I think the issues we're seeing now are much more to do with how the payment structures are designed rather than the actual money.
This long delay and the monthly rather than the...
Getting rid of or reducing the kind of enforced waiting days of a week at the beginning would be a good start, and then allowing more flexibility for the claimant in terms of their payments. But also, I think there is an operational issue as well, and we're hearing stories about job centres not necessarily being fully briefed on what the different elements of Universal Credit are. I mean, the work coaches within the job centres generally do an amazing job, and they're having to do more and more and deal with more and more complex cases as Universal Credit switches into the more complicated categories. And we're also having to think about how to help people to progress in work when they're on Universal Credit. So that's another switch of bringing the whole system together, is that whereas before on tax credits, you really didn't have much interaction with HMRC day to day in terms of your amount, and it was an annual award. Now it's going to be much more in your face as a claimant, even when you're in work, and you might need to kind of earn more to reach certain thresholds or work more hours. And the work coaches are there to support people to do that, but there are a whole questions
there. You need to understand
about
how it works. Yeah, so what will it mean for people?
And what does the labour market look like in their areas? What's the views of employers? Are they going to kind of play ball and help people to progress or even change jobs if that's what's required? So that is a whole other area of headache that is coming down the track when tax credit claimants migrate over to Universal Credit.
Mm. And these changes are always, which, you know, are complex and create winners and losers, are always easier to implement in a time when there's plenty of money to spare, aren't they? Do you think Philip Hammond is going to come under pressure? I mean, he's certainly saying there's not much cash to spare at the budget. One doesn't get the impression that he's going to be generous, but would it be a good use of spare resources, do you think, to try and do something to this system?
Yeah, I definitely think so. It is the main means of getting money and support to millions and millions of people on low income. So its benefit is that it is targeting that support through one system. So it's got to be used to help them.
And I'm joined on the line now by Devon Galani, Director of the Consultancy Policy in Practice. Devon Galani, you were one of the architects of this system. When you see the reporting, the stories and the things that are being raised by MPs about cases they're hearing in their surgeries and so on, about long delays to payments and the complexity of the system people are finding and the sort of problems with the rollouts, do you worry about the system and whether it's doing what it was originally set out to do, or do you think these are teething problems and we'll get through it?
Well, I think it's absolutely, I ought to worry, I think, having been part of the original idea and the idea behind Universal Credit. I think that's a healthy thing to do, because it's a massive change. And actually, if any degree of complacency on a change that's going to affect 7 or 8 million households when it's fully rolled out is, it's important not to be complacent. It's important to worry and listen to these cases, stories, and think about what the department, what local organizations, what others can do to support households that are affected by this change. We need to think about, I think about some of the challenges that Universal Credit is facing in a couple of different ways. The first one is to think about, well, actually, around Universal Credit, there are a whole range of challenges that people face today. Alongside a major reform to the benefit system, there's also been a lot of money taken out of welfare support for low-income households. I think even things like that there is a policy rationale for the 6-week waits for the first Universal Credit payment, but equally, I think it could be resolved with money. You could pay people, more people up front, and actually that's some of what the advance payments will hopefully set out to do.
What's the policy rationale for it? Why wait? Why should people wait that long for their money? What was the intention of that?
The policy rationale is fundamentally to try and make benefits feel like work. So under the current benefit system, what we found was when people moved into work, they were facing exactly the same sort of challenges that we're hearing about now in the context of Universal Credit.
Because you don't get paid till the end of the month, as it were.
Yeah. You might have to wait a month for your first paycheck. There would be uncertainty around your income, and actually it was acting as a barrier to moving into work. I think the rationale behind Universal Credit particularly for those that can cope with a 6-week wait. And let's be clear about what we need to do about those that can't. And I'll come on to that in a second. But for those that can cope, actually, it sort of eases, it should help to ease that transition into work. And it should reduce the uncertainty because Universal Credit fundamentally mirrors, it was set out to mirror that sort of same payment method and mechanism of paid work.
So once you're on the system, you could move into or out of the workplace, and there'd be continuity, as it were. You'd be on the same.
Yeah, and Universal Credit would adjust according to your earnings as and when they changed. Again, we're moving more into a flexible hours economy. I think a benefit system needs to be able to be responsive and flexible to that. And I think when the other group of households are those that are struggling and can't cope, and we're talking about the letters that MPs are having with households that have moved on to Universal Credit, and absolutely support needs to be in place to help those households. In some cases, that needs to be financial support. So I think the move toward making people aware of advance payments, exactly how much they can get, and lengthening the period over which they have to pay it back are good, positive steps by EWP around something that they could change quite quickly without having to go back to policy and legislation to try and change actually some of the fundamentals around how Universal Credit is currently set up. It was the quickest fix for them to deal with what they've recognized, I think, is a major issue. We've got a budget coming up middle of November, November 22nd, and I think it's another opportunity then for Conservative backbenchers and the opposition to really make the case for investing in Universal Credit, because it shouldn't just be something that's delivered by the department. I think it's got to be something that's delivered by the government. And a major reform on this scale, I think it makes sense to invest in it. Otherwise, people will be, you don't want to sort of do these things half-heartedly.
And you would like to see it made more generous, because at the moment...
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I think the idea was to make people better off in work. Universal Credit does do that, but less so than the current tax credit system, which is strange because it was being introduced as a reform to make work pay. And to do that, unfortunately, because of the way you actually have to invest in it, you have to invest in support for people in work for that to happen.
Okay, but you think if it were made less generous, and it sounds as though you hope that something at least that the Chancellor will consider, there's certainly a lot of political pressure in that direction, but you think the design of the system fundamentally can work? Is it, we've got some teething problems. It's not as generous as it should be, but it's a good reform that's worth pressing ahead with.
I think making it more generous solves one of the major concerns around it. I think the teething problems, some of them are quite serious, and I think some of them need to be looked at. Some of them can be resolved through kind of operational considerations. Policy and Practice actually hosted an event just yesterday evening where we had frontline advisors engaging with DWP policymakers to try and create an opportunity for DWP to hear very much firsthand from people working on the front line some of the challenges that Universal Credit is facing, but also to hear some of the simple solutions and greater flexibilities that advisors on the front line felt actually if these were introduced, it would go a long way to enabling them to help their customers and their residents to make a Universal Credit claim successfully and reduce the burden on those households. So yeah, I think it's a positive reform that is going to face some serious challenges because of the scale at which it's being implemented. And I think but it's also an area where the policy rationale is sound. I think the money needs to go into it, and we all need to work hard to think about how we can make it work as effectively as possible.
Devon Ghilani, thank you very much. Well, you can find all our reporting on the rollout of Universal Credit at theguardian.com/society. Now, party conference season is drawing to a close for another year, and this week it was the turn of the SNP and the Green Party. We'll hear from Glasgow shortly, but first I'm joined on the line by the co-leader of the Green Party, Jonathan Bartley. Jonathan, what was the mood at your conference? You had a really impressive set of local election results earlier in the year, but you weren't really able to translate that, were you, into an improvement in your showing at the general election?
No, I think everyone, the mood is the question you asked. The mood at the conference is fantastic. It really is positive. But you're right, it was a disappointing result in a very difficult set of circumstances. And I guess so I expected the mood to be a little down, but it isn't. and it's really been great to see the level of debate, the enthusiasm for the future. As you said, we won council elections before the general election. We're the only party beside the Conservatives to make gains in May's council elections. Since the general election, we've also taken more seats and had more wins. We've got May's local elections coming up in May next year as well. I'm announced that I'm going to be a candidate myself in those council elections. And we know that under our kind of broken electoral system, which does very much focus on two parties, you have to win those council seats at the local level in order then to make a bid for the parliamentary seats.
So it's about a kind of grassroots approach.
Very much a grassroots approach, yeah. But I think there's also a realisation that when 22 local parties decided to stand down in the election, and of course that was had an implication.
This idea of the Progressive Alliance that you and your Caroline are very keen on. This is the idea of working together, isn't it, with Labour and the Lib Dems in particular seats.
The goal was to secure proportional representation, so to get a government in place that would embrace PR and to work together with other parties, recognising that we've got to change the system. But sadly, Labour, Lib Dems didn't want to play ball. But there was a recognition that the kind of consequence of those 22 parties standing down was that they made the difference in getting the hung parliament. And that has changed the political landscape substantially in terms of the parliamentary agenda. It's had a huge impact on British politics for the next 2 years, probably the next 5 years.
But is that quite a bitter pill to swallow for some of your activists? Wouldn't they rather see more Green support than support going to other parties?
Well, of course, we're a very decentralised structure. So in those 22 seats, it was the local parties that made the call.
Indeed.
And in other areas of the country, local parties had the discussion, decided not to. So, it's very much in their hands and they were the ones making the choice.
We've got a Labour Party now that seems to have been, Jeremy Corbyn's approach is to take a very kind of open arms approach to backers of other parties or former backers of other parties, isn't it? And to talk a bit more about the environment, perhaps, than his predecessors, are a lot of your voters headed that way? That's certainly how it looked from some of the results, wasn't it?
I mean, we've been sitting right a few metres away from our chief exec. He's been commissioning some great research into what happened with the votes actually at the general election, looking at the election studies both kind of before, during and after the election. And there was an incredible amount of churn, a really surprising amount of churn. And what has been clear as we've been discussing at conference here is actually what Labour have been suggesting on the environment. When you look at the detail, there's a lot of rhetoric there, and definitely there's a step in the right direction. But to give you some examples, let's say what's happening in London, you can't tackle the air pollution crisis while expanding City Airport, while building the Silvertown Tunnel, while giving the green light to more incinerators. You can't have that renewable energy revolution at the national level while backing Hinkley. It's a £30 billion white elephant, really. And now even offshore wind is significantly cheaper than the strike price that's been negotiated for Hinkley. Hinkley, of course, means a very centralised energy system, not a decentralised one, makes us potentially quite insecure, and will lock us into a bad deal with a technology that hasn't worked and been proven to work anywhere else in the world. The reactor hasn't worked anywhere else in the world. So, there's some very clear, obvious issues where we are very, very different to Labour in that area. Now, in other areas, of course, there's no commitment to electoral reform from Labour. We are still absolutely proud to champion freedom of movement, which Labour are not doing. We're talking about some very big, bold ideas on four-day working week, on reforming the welfare state and basic income. So, there are many, many different areas right across the different policy areas.
And as Brexit goes through, is part of what you'll be trying to campaign on and trying to make clear the risks of Brexit to the environment? Is there a kind of Brexit that we could have that would be green? Michael Gove has talked about a green Brexit, hasn't he?
I think it's a bit of an oxymoron, frankly. Michael, it's priceless, Michael Gove, Michael Gove's comments at Conservative Party conference. I think that is more about the Tories reckoning that they have to appeal to that younger vote. So at the Conservative Party conference, one think tank commissioned some research through YouGov, which showed that under 40s, the second highest ranked issue is climate change. Under 29s, it's the number one ranked issue that they want politicians to talk more about. So they're reckoning that they have to somehow get into that territory. But I think almost by definition, the Conservatives seem to be anti-environment. It seems to be every decision they make, whether it be fracking or fossil fuel subsidies or whatever, is anti everything that we're pushing forward and standing for. So, clearly Conservatives are recognising they can't duck the issue, that they're going to have to talk about it, but I don't hold out much hope for them really taking steps in the right direction.
Jonathan Bartley, co-leader of the Green Party there. Now, in Glasgow this week, members of the Scottish National Party have been gathering to reflect on a year in which their parliamentary contingent was thinned out in the election after a surprising surge in support for the Scottish Conservatives. Nicola Sturgeon took to the stage this afternoon.
As I have always said, Scotland should have the right to choose our future when the terms of Brexit are clear. We have a mandate to give people that choice, and that mandate was won fairly and squarely. But exercising it must be done with the interests of all of Scotland at heart. People want clarity about Brexit first, and we respect that. But to all of you here in this hall and across our country who are impatient for change, let me say this. We may not yet know exactly when the choice will be made, but we can, we must, and we will make the case for independence always.
We're here just as everybody's filing out of the hall, and do you want to just sort of tell me what your thoughts were on the speech today?
As a councillor, Dundee City Council, I thought it was amazing that there's all that offer on for housing, mm-hmm. and affordable housing, because we do need affordable housing in the city, of course, and basically it's take it or lose it, and if other councils don't want it, then we'll definitely take it.
Yeah.
So that was one of the highlights for me, and also the very fact that it's all about the future generations. Mm-hmm. It focuses on the climate change, and just as a mother, it's just amazing that there is so much emphasis on education and a better future for my son, so that he doesn't have the brain drain that I had and having to leave Scotland to get jobs elsewhere.
Yeah, brilliant. And what were your thoughts on it?
As Young Scot of the Year, it was such a pleasure to hear everything that she spoke about, our aspirations for the young people in Scotland, and especially the council tax being exempt for looked after children. That's something that I've been working a lot in my city, and that was such a great announcement, which I was really happy about today.
I'm back in the press room now and speaking to Angela Haggerty, who is editor of the Common Space News website and also Sunday Herald columnist. Angela, what were your thoughts on the speech?
I thought that there was a few interesting announcements. The key one really was the announcement that there's going to be a publicly owned not-for-profit energy company set up before the end of this parliament, which is, you know, potentially quite a huge thing, because we know what we know of the controversies around the big energy companies and fuel bills people are struggling with right now. So I think that policy is going to go down a storm with people. I think the childcare policy, increasing the amount of childcare that's going to be available, and the amount of money that they're going to be spending on that, I thought that was quite good too. I think that will go down well. The stuff that she said on immigration and Europe, and I mean, it was very progressive, kind of internationalist tones. I think generally with the SNP party faithful, I think it will have gone down well enough. But when I was asking people after what they thought of it, the key thing really for everyone sitting in that room was independence. You know, that's what they want, something on that. And in terms of that, the speech was actually really quite thin. It was just soundbite stuff, but there was nothing substantial. So I think the policies will actually be popular generally among the public, but among the SNP, independence is still, there's just a little kind of sense of restlessness, I think.
SNP members talking there to our Scotland reporter Libby Brooks. I'm joined on the line now by our Scotland editor Severin Carell. Sev, a year ago, the SNP was a party that was riding high, hoping to capitalise on the Brexit vote, which obviously Scotland didn't support, and Nicola Sturgeon appeared to be rather sort of Teflon coated. She was, you know, Westminster based politicians looked at her with some envy, really. Is the mood rather different there this year?
Yes, the mood at this conference is much more subdued. There's a sense now that the party has had a really very difficult year, much more difficult than they had anticipated. I mean, the difficulty for them, of course, is that the tide had risen so high after the independence referendum, membership reaching 120,000. They pretty much won the 2016 Scottish elections, although they failed to get an overall majority. And then, of course, there was that extraordinary 2015 general election result when they won pretty much all Scotland's Westminster seats. And now there's the inevitable contraction. But the real problem for the party is that Nicola Sturgeon's big gamble, her big play to explicitly link Scotland's anti-Brexit vote with independence has failed. And that's been a chastening experience for her, and it's been a chastening experience for the party.
And is that because people saw it as opportunistic, do you think? Or just people are fed up talking about independence? It certainly didn't seem to be what people wanted to talk about during the general election campaign in Scotland, did it?
I think all of those things. I think there were a whole series of reasons. There were voters who were, as the Scottish word goes, scummered with referendums and general elections and so forth. There was a sense that Nicola Sturgeon, for many voters, was being, you know, very opportunistic and had failed to properly understand exactly what the Scottish electorate wanted. I mean, in some respects, it was a remarkable turnaround because one of the great successes of the SNP had been in accurately gauging where the middle ground of Scottish political and popular opinion sat. That's the reason why they'd been so successful in not only winning power in 2007, but building and building and building up until that crescendo of 2015. The difficulty for Sturgeon was that although a majority of Scots may prefer to stay in the EU, that does not mean a majority of Scots believe that staying in the EU is the most important thing in their lives. Caring about the economy, caring about general stability, caring about the provision of proper and decent services such as schools and medical hospital services and so forth was actually also very, very important. And that one of the big attacks from the opposition that really stuck with voters was the idea that the SNP needed to get on with a day job.
That's a clever line, isn't it? And to what extent are members, when you're up there, you know, in the bars and the coffee shops and whatever, do they blame Nicola Sturgeon to any extent? Is it she regarded as having made a mistake with that big bold move?
Yes, there is that sense now. I mean, it's quite rare for SNP activists and members to openly criticise the leader. There have been moments during debates in conference where senior activists from various branches have openly said that they thought that the party leadership had misread the voters, misread the electorate. And there are people speaking privately too, saying, feeling some frustration, some annoyance that this big gambit of hers back in March, which if you remember when it came out, actually really did appear to have seized the moment, to seize the political mood, has backfired
spectacularly. It knocked Downing Street for six for a bit. They weren't quite sure how to respond to it. And you're right, it looked as if she'd made a rather clever play. And what are the big issues being discussed up there on the conference floor, Seb? I mean, is Brexit being talked about a lot? And to what extent is there still a push to crack on with an independence referendum?
Well, the Brexit is being discussed in the main conference debates, and it's also certainly being discussed in the fringe meetings. There are roughly 12 fringe events dedicated to Brexit. But the Brexit motions that are going to the conference floor are very non-confrontational. They are motions which are boosting the main kind of positioning, marketing position that the SNP want about protecting EU safeguards, protecting EU citizens, and so on and so forth. What there isn't is a debate on the conference floor about whether an independent Scotland should actually try and be a member of the EU again, or whether it should join the EEA or EFTA, as Norway does. Now, that's quite important because it does show that this conversation inside the SNP isn't yet maturing into a real debate about the future of Scotland. It's much more about supporting Nicola Sturgeon's broad her attacks on the UK government and trying to position the SNP as a party of Europe in a fairly bland way. Now, there are topics on the conference floor which are relatively controversial but still fairly low grade, such as pressing for the MOD to stop recruiting 16 and 17-year-olds to the armed forces. That was forced through almost unanimously by conference delegates, even though the party leadership was quite hostile to that position. And there are some fairly modest things as well about tenement rights of, you know, people living in tenements, sex for rent exploitation by landlords, digital technologies in the future. So it's a bit of a mix, I have to say. Independence, however, is not making any appearance at all as a conference debate. The question really is just about backing up Nicola Sturgeon and not producing anything that's going to be remotely controversial.
And not binding her hands, by the sound of it.
Exactly.
Okay, Severin Quayle, thank you very much. And you can read all of Severin Libby's reporting from north of the border at theguardian.com/politics. And why not try our Long Reads podcast, which this week features the inside story of Labour's 2017 election campaign, written by, me. Well, that's all we have time for this week. My thanks to all my guests. The producer was Phil Maynard. I'm Heather Stewart. Thanks for listening.